Hello, everyone, and welcome to Wisdom Calls One. We have a great hour ahead of us with a spectacular speaker on an absolutely fascinating subject. So let's start, as we do each week, by taking a few deep breaths and getting grounded and really getting present for this call. So take a big deep breath in, lady, and slowly let it out. And as you do so, let go of all the commotion around you. Let go of the demands of your daily life and really settle into the space of this moment. And now take another deep breath and think of you and how amazing and wonderful you are. Give yourself a big high five for taking time for yourself, for your education, for your empowerment. This is your time. It is all about self-love, ladies. And then as you take a final deep breath in and slowly release it, I'm going to read a short piece from Elizabeth Clare Prophet that I found to be quite amazing. And she says, "The study of geometry, which descends to us from Pythagoras, is a meditation on the harmony of the cosmic order. And it is a meditation upon music. If you meditate upon geometry instead of just learning it in a linear way, you can actually hear the music of the spheres, because the geometric forms will key the eye and the ear to the inner sound. Every line that you draw, you have the carryover from the spiritual octaves to the physical. So geometry, mathematics, calculus, make the transition from the concrete to the non-concrete. So Pythagoras knew what he was doing when he gave that subject of geometry to the world. He knew that ultimately the lovers of truth and the true devotees would pass through it into the higher exaltation of his soul. His esoteric teaching did not live on, but his geometry was like the parables of Christ. Hidden in it are the sacred mysteries." And ladies, we have with us today a gentleman who can relate to those words deeply. He's been involved in one form or another with the amazing subject of sacred geometry for over 40 years. He has explored the subjects of ancient architecture, archetypal astrology, electronic music, computer graphics, and so much more. And the subject of the sacred geometry, it fascinates me. And I've wanted to have someone speak to us for quite some time. And I will tell you, after my research, we are extremely lucky and very blessed to have Mr. Bruce Rawls with us. So I'm going to have him get right to it.
Okay.
Thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
You're welcome. And I'm going to let you dive right into this amazing subject of sacred geometry. So can you start by just telling us, you know, how you got involved in sacred geometry? I mean, did you love math as a kid, or architecture, or like history and the Greeks and the Romans or something? Or
all the above. Yeah, I've always get asked that, and it's always kind of funny because I've shared this a number of times in different contexts and different occasions, and I listen to this story that I tell. It's like, who is it that's telling the story? And it's just kind of an amusing side note, but it is kind of fun to just think back to my high school days. It was actually my mom, who's literally been my metaphysical and spiritual mentor from day one, gave me a couple of books when I was in my high school, college era. And one of them was Secrets of the Great Pyramid by Peter Tompkins. And another was This Living Earth by David Cavagnaro. And what both of those books had in them was references to something called the golden ratio, or the golden section, or the golden mean. It goes by a number of different names, like the phi proportion, the extreme and mean ratio, a whole bunch of different names that it goes by. But essentially, it's a mathematical proportion that's about 1.618 to 1, or 0.618 to 1. Depends on how you look at it. Either way is the same. It's just one's in the numerator, one's in the denominator. But anyway, the math, I've always kind of had an interest in math, not so much from the pragmatic only point of view, although I find that interesting too, but more the mystical point of view. It's like I've always kind of wanted to know, what is it that is universal? What is it that we can share with each other that goes beyond cultural or gender or age or any other kind of boundaries that reinforce a belief in separation and get to the heart of what we actually have as one spirit, as one being that we share. And so that inquiry led me into sacred geometry with those two books. One, the Great Pyramid book, talked about how this golden proportion was embedded in the architecture of the Great Pyramid in Egypt, often attributed to Cheops, but I like to say that that's kind of like, you know, a pharaoh putting his graffiti although I don't think it's actually been found on that pyramid, a structure that had been around already for many hundreds, if not thousands, or maybe even tens of thousands of years. another side story that we could get into, but kind of the metaphor would be like calling the White House the Bush House or the Obama House. You know, there have been other, you know, people and residents before. So calling it the Cheops Pyramid to me seems kind of silly. But anyway, in the structure, the apothem, which is a measurement of, if you take each of the four triangular faces of the pyramid, there on the Giza Plateau, and there's three large ones, but the largest one is called the Great Pyramid. And you take one of those triangular faces and then divide it right down the middle. And that line that goes from the top of the pyramid to the middle of one of the base sides is called the apothem. And if you take the ratio of the apothem to one of those bisected base sides, one of those sides along the ground that you cut in half there, that proportion is very, very closely 1.618 to 1. And also the circumference of the pyramid compared to its altitude is also the pi proportion. So it's kind of interesting. You have that embedded in there as well. So whoever architected the Great Pyramid had some pretty interesting things going on mathematically. And there's a whole bunch of other stuff. I could spend a whole hour just talking about the Great Pyramid, but it's just riddled with, pun intended, with fascinating mathematics and geometry and acoustics as well. And that's what originally led me to explore that. I wrote a computer program back in the days of punch cards and Fortran, if anybody remembers those days. And when I was in high school, I grew up in Livermore, California, and I remember writing down in the back of my computer instructor's Volkswagen bus with three or four other guys crammed in there with their decks of cards, and we ran it in the CDC 3400 on East Avenue in Livermore, and I had this printout that printed out all the resonant frequencies of and their harmonics of the chambers and passageways of the Great Pyramid. I thought, well, this is kind of interesting. I thought, why did they encode these really unique resonant proportions? And what I discovered was that, you know, there was a whole lot more to it. And then I mentioned this other book, This Living Earth by David Cavagnaro, and this just one of these nice little coffee table books that had lots of pretty pictures of nature and some beautiful photography, and that kind of got me into taking pictures of dewdrops on cobwebs and crawling around Point Reyes National Seashore with a buddy of mine who's still around in Colorado, and you know, would put slideshows and set them to music and have great fun with that. And in that book, there was also this mention of this golden ratio, this proportion that was encoded in the pyramid as well as in nature. And I thought, well, that's kind of interesting. And then I came to discover that it's not only in the cross-section of every DNA molecule because of the pentagon proportion, the five-pointed star and pentagon have that golden ratio or a phi proportion or phi, depending on how you pronounce it, the Greek letter, encoded everywhere you have an edible fruit, you have a five-pointed flower, so that intrinsic geometry is there. If you stand with your feet outstretched and your arms outstretched, your body tends to make a pentagram. So the DNA, in addition to having a pentagonal cross-section, which is really two decagons that ratchet or spiral down in a helical fashion, it also has on the side chains off that double spiral, there's little pentagonal clusters of the amino acids. I think a couple of them have a pentagonal cluster. And then to kind of top it off, the ratio of one complete turn of the DNA spiral is 34 over 21 angstroms to the diameter. So that those numbers just coincidentally happen to be two Fibonacci numbers that tie into the proportions that you get when you take lots of natural sequences. It's in the plant and animal kingdoms. It's everywhere you look. For example, you can take the population of drone bees, and you start out with one and one, and then you add the previous two generations to get the total for the current generation. So one and one is two. One and two makes three. Two and three make five. Three and five make eight. And then the next terms are 13, 21, 34, and there's our two numbers that we just talked about in the DNA cross-section ratio. So it's 21 angstroms in diameter by 34 angstroms long for one turn of the DNA spiral. And then you take that proportion, and then you keep going in terms of that series called the Fibonacci series, and you get up to 55 and 89 and 144, and it just goes on from there to infinity. And it turns out that if you get mathematically, in the pure abstract sense, out to infinity on that series, the ratio of two one term to its previous term is exactly the golden ratio, and you can prove that mathematically. So all this kind of stuff was just fascinating to me when I was in high school. And when I went off to college to UC Davis, I devoured everything I could find in the Shields Library on the divine proportion, the golden ratio, and architecture and art and things like that. And of course, the Renaissance artists totally, you know, were enamored with this. Da Vinci and certainly Plato and Pythagoras knew about it, and Raphael and so many other masters in the Renaissance era intentionally use that proportion by making what are called golden rectangles, which is essentially the same shape we were talking about, the pyramid. And if you take that apothem to half base side, if you're to take that one of the triangular faces of the pyramid and flop it over to where you have, you know, the diagonals lined up, you get a golden rectangle. So essentially each face of the Great Pyramid is a golden rectangle cut in half and then flopped over, if you want to look at it that way. But that golden rectangle finds its way into paintings like Mona Lisa, The Last Supper, and then, of course, Salvador Dali did an incredible painting that I got to see at the Smithsonian years ago. It was just breathtakingly beautiful, The Sacrament of the Last Supper, which depicts Jesus and the 12 disciples in a dodecahedron, which is a three-dimensional shape that has 12 pentagons around a single point. And I'm not necessarily, you know, that much involved in the religious aspects, but I think the symbolic metaphysic aspects of the 12 around one leading back to that unity is really pretty wonderful. So anyway, there's just all kinds of connections through art and nature, and that whole study is really kind of what launched me into it. And then in recent years, I've found that there's hermetic laws that tie into these sacred geometric forms and shapes that again can be used to with one of two directions that we have at every moment. We can either use it to separate or to divide, or to bring to a generalization to an abstraction of finding, and I mean abstract in the best possible way, finding what's common or what are the shared interests that people have. And that's my interest at this point, is to look at symbols as metaphors for reminding us that we can use any experience. I mean, geometry is just one study or one discipline that can be used to look at the our imagined universe as I've come to know it, and look at how we can take the experiences that we have and apply them to either bring ourselves together with, you know, I think the Dalai Lama said it really well. You know, he was asked what his philosophy was in one word, and he said kindness, you know, and I think, well, that kind of sums it up pretty nicely. So anyway, what seems like a very arcane subject, actually, I think ultimately, you know, given that perspective, we can use that as a tool or a metaphor to get us back to a very pragmatic and very useful, practical study that leads us back to a very peaceful awareness that we've never left, ultimately. So anyway, how's that for a quick intro?
Wow. I can't remember the map, but I do that.
So anyway.
Yeah, I mean, to me, the study, it's so in depth, and it is so, like, kind of all encompassing. It can be very, very, very overwhelming.
Yeah, and I think I like what you said, all encompassing, and I think that really is the essence of what inspired me from a kind of a mystical standpoint to want to know why are these symbols important. Well, ultimately, anything having to do with form or space or time or bodies or even our personas that we are so enamored with are just placeholders. They're substitutes for an essence that goes beyond all those things that we all share, and that's, I think, to me, is the whole point of the idea of going home to an awareness that we've never left, that is peaceful and wonderful beyond our wildest imaginations, is the whole premise of so many mystical studies over millennia. And it's interesting that I think that modern physics has been helping us in the last century to really, if we want to look at the take-home lessons, realize that the whole notion of separation or the belief in a dualistic universe is only a mental construct, and that is all. And again, that sounds like a kind of a wild extrapolation, but if you really think of what happened about a half century ago or more in Copenhagen, Einstein and Bohr and Planck and Bohm, and a lot of these folks were, I don't recall exactly who was there, but there was a meeting of some of the world's, leading physicists, and they looked at some of the things that were coming out in quantum theory. And one of them was the wave-particle duality. And what that basically surfaced was the idea that an electron or a photon, all these different particles, would behave as either a wave or a particle depending on the expectation of the observer. So that to me is like, okay, if you really take that and really think about what that implies, that means that our material world, as we think of it, is the byproduct of our preconceptions or our expectations. And so really, it's really the thought system that we bring to anything that determines the outcome. And we can have a thought system that leads toward a healing of the belief that things are separate and all that implies, all the specialness that goes along with that we get hung up in. Or we can use it to further dig ourselves into a deeper hole of believing that we're stuck in a cosmos that makes no sense. So anyway, I choose to participate in the former more and more, and am realizing that there are actually these hermetic laws that I remember getting exposed to back in the mid to early 70s actually, there's a book called The Kabbalion. Not to be confused with the Kabbalah, although I'm sure there's plenty of connections there. But this was written about a century ago by the three initiates from the Yogi Publication Society. And you can actually find the whole text of it online. I have a link to it, I think, somewhere on one of my websites. By the way, if anybody's interested in studying this more in depth, I have a website called geometrycode.com. And I'm just about getting ready to send out my monthly email bulletin. So if you want to jump on that and subscribe, you'll get my October-November bulletin, which I'm putting together today. The Kabbalion has these wonderful seven hermetic laws that each relate to a geometric symbol, which I find is really helpful because dealing directly with just pure oneness, we need, which to me I think is the whole point of any kind of spiritual or metaphysical inquiry, we need placeholders, we need training wheels to get us back to that awareness of the undifferentiated oneness. And that's why I think these seven hermetic laws come in really handy. Ultimately, it's all about forgiving the dream we made up, but these laws can be really helpful, and they have geometric counterparts as well. So the second book I'm working on, making pretty good headway on this year, is going to talk about these seven hermetic laws and the seven symbols that go with them. So the first one is the law of mentalism. And that one, the Kybalion, this wonderful little unassuming book that came out again about a century ago, says that all is mind, everything is mental. And talk about a perfect reflection of what the folks in Copenhagen were saying almost, you know, more than a half century ago, that our expectations really do determine the outcome. And so we are not so much receivers of the sensory data as much as projectors. And I think if we kind of turn that equation around, it puts the onus back on us, which is actually a good thing, because that means that we no longer are at the mercy of what seems to be happening around us, but we are actually determining by which interpretation we choose moment to moment whether something is for our benefit and for everyone's benefit, which is the only way that really works, or something that is a grievance that we should somehow hang on to and mess around with. And I'm sure your listeners will probably relate to the idea that you know, if we hold on to grievances, I mean, certainly it's appropriate to grieve when things don't seem to be going the way we want them to, but it's the attachment to and the hanging on to those things that tends to perpetuate or emphasize the alleged or so-called reality of those events for us. And so it's the law of mentalism, I think it's really an important one. And right off the bat, a symbol I think that works really well with the law of mentalism is a circle. So you have basically the idea of a circle is, and which of course is a very feminine form right off the bat, you have a point that is beyond dimension, beyond any kind of duality, beyond any sort of polarization of any kind, at the heart of the circle, which is then a perfect egalitarian shape that embraces and encompasses all, as you said eloquently at the beginning of our conversation here, that if we encompass the all and we don't try to make anything more special than anything else, that is a huge key, I think, toward forgiving our misperceptions and letting go of our interpretations that bias ourselves toward things that keep us stuck in circumstances, not only physically but mentally, which is really where the causal aspects occur. And so a circle then can be a reminder, whenever you see a circle, that we have a choice, and we can choose moment to moment what we want to see in each situation. We can use the law of mentalism to encompass or embrace everything as equally valid in terms of inspiring us to see the beauty and the wisdom in each moment, or we can use it as a prison. And so the circle, again, is all the other symbols have a double meaning. The circle with infinite diameter is like the cosmos that embraces all, that encompasses everything. And we welcome everyone equally, not necessarily in a physical way, because obviously, you know, if you have a party, you know, you're not going to invite 7 billion people, but it's just the spirit behind it, I think, that's important. That if we would mentally exclude anyone from our kindness or caring, then that is, then we're using the circle in a, shall we say, a degenerate fashion or destructive fashion, because then we're kind of using it to separate the within from the without. So if that circle, metaphorically, or a sphere, if you want to think in three dimensions, is finite, then there's the inner circle, and then there's the outer circle. And then we have the haves and the have-nots, or the we and the they, and that then becomes a polarization that excludes rather than includes. So again, a real simple universal symbol that is just about everywhere we look can be a reminder moment to moment whenever we see something with a circle, whether it's the knob on the equipment that I'm sitting in front of, or someone's eye, or the sun, or a manhole cover. you can find them everywhere in both man-made and natural, the natural world. These symbols are everywhere, and so you can use anything as a reminder to let go of our personal interpretation and instead choose a transpersonal or metapersonal interpretation that can be more helpful. So that's the first of the seven laws, and the first symbol, which is the the circle. And I also like to think that, you know, the circle is kind of like in terms of the ancient symbolism of what I was thinking about the word scapegoat recently, and I was thinking, well, it's sort of like anything that's within the inner circle is you know, the lambs in the fold kind of thing, and everything outside is the scapegoat, you know. So really, our mental world can be thought of as either being inclusive, which dissolves that boundary and lets that circle expand to infinity, or we can constrict down to nothing by making that circle ever smaller, and then everything else is out on the goatscape, so to speak. So anyway, that's just kind of, I like to play with words too. So what can I say? So the next of the seven symbols that I like to share is from these Hermetic laws is the law of correspondence, and that's the classic as above, so below; as below, so above. And that certainly works in the world of the macro and the micro. And I think probably a lot of your listeners are familiar with astrological symbolism and the influences of the cosmos on the very small, you know, here down in, I like to call our place on Earth Whoville. I saw Dr. Seuss's Horton Hears a Who a few months ago, and it just really struck me as what a great metaphor of, you know, we're down in this little tiny speck of a planet, and we make such a big deal out of all the things that happen or seem to happen to us in our lives and blow them all out of proportion. And it's that cosmic perspective, I think, that helps, you know, when we expand that circle, see the above and the below is really connected. And also, I think the within and the without is when we recognize that, you know, again, tying it into this law of mentalism, that we're actually projecting what we see and what we experience moment to moment. Certainly, what seems to be our external environment can have an enormous influence on us, but that's only because we've taught ourselves that so vigorously and so thoroughly that's how it's supposed to go, that we forget that, well, gee, maybe the projector in the theater is more important to deal with rather than trying to adjust things on the screen once the film's already been shot. And so that's kind of a neat metaphor there. And then so the lens, whether it's a projector or a camera or our eyes, is a great symbol. So if you take two circles, and again, real simple geometry, because I think it really helps to keep it. I mean, there's plenty of really wonderful complex geometries out there, and then that's kind of fun to dabble with. But I think when we get back to just, again, real simple shapes and universal types of metaphors, was a shape called the Vesica Pisces, which is also known as the almond or mandorla. There's a symbol there that, again, when you see eye to eye, or the eyes in the mirror of the soul, those are the kind of things that come to mind when you look at that symbol. And I'm looking at photos of my grandkids here, and they're smiling faces, and they're, you know, their eyes beaming that kind of warmth and radiance. And when you meet someone and you share that kind of connection, there's that correspondence again. So again, anytime you see overlapping circles where metaphorically the way that shape is formed for the pure geometric Vesica Pisces shape is you take two circles of the same diameter and you overlap them in such a way that they share a common radius, or metaphorically the circumference of one touches the heart or center of another. And so what happens when we're really sharing heart to heart? Well, isn't that a great metaphor? I think so. And there's the eye, the mirror of the soul, and all that sort of thing. And again, the Renaissance artists, in addition to the pentagon, and the golden rectangle, golden triangle, if you analyze a lot of those medieval and Renaissance canvases, they used the Vesica shape tremendously. Oftentimes, the figure of Christ was depicted in the mandorla or vesical shape, again, because it's a metaphor for the vision or seeing eye to eye, or seeing literally, again, the two metaphors. We can either use it to exclude and say what's shared, which is that lens shape in the middle, or we can say, well, what's different, which is the rest of the circle that's cut apart. And it's that the transpersonal, I like to think, is the metaphor that incorporates or is all-encompassing or all-inclusive, and abolishes the problems of the specialness of exclusion, and instead relates to the feeling of inclusiveness, which I think is what's so healing in our world. And that takes, that manifests in so many ways, so many countless ways that we can apply that. But it's that feeling of inclusion, that of seeing eye to eye, that really, you know, gets us home there. So that's just the first two of these seven symbols. If you want, I could, you know, talk about the other five and go from there. Does that sound good?
Sure, absolutely. It's amazing.
Okay. Okay. So when you get past mentalism and correspondence to the third one, you get to vibration as the third of these seven hermetic laws. And the law of vibration in the Kabbalion is everything vibrates, nothing rests, everything is in motion. And that basically tells us that what we experience with our senses, again, has a frequency to it, and or more generally, a spectrum associated with each of our senses. And the important thing to me, again, the take-home lesson is always, what thought system are we using? Are we using a personal limiting thought system that basically focuses on one little part of the whole and distorts it? Or are we looking to find that inner guidance that helps us to generalize and find the inclusive qualities that bring us home, that bring us to a point of resonance and harmony with other people? And I think that's a real powerful one, because we can use our minds, you know, again, these laws all work together to correspond through the law of vibration with other people as we perceive them. Again, modern physics tells us there really isn't any other people. It's just a mental fabrication that we use for convenience. But, you know, again, that's a pretty tough one to swallow, and that's why the physicists back then were in Copenhagen were saying, how do we explain this to people, that there really is no space and time? You know? But anyway, but we have to deal with that, so we need some tools to get us back to that cosmic mystical understanding. And the law of vibration, I think, is a really important one, because we can choose to resonate with or harmoniously relate to any experience that seems to be happening by not resisting our inner guidance and not resisting our inspirational nature. And that's where the vibratory rates, if you want to think of it as a higher octave, you know, whatever metaphor works for you, can come to the fore and bring us to understanding that every experience is ultimately for our benefit, seen from that perspective, that every seeming set of sensory data, which takes all these countless different spectra of vibrations and all the different senses that we have, they seem to be different, and yet there is a fundamental oneness or unity that is shared with every experience, that if we can learn to generalize, that can help us relate to each experience in a much more effective and helpful way. So a symbol for the law of vibration would just be a sine wave, and probably everyone is familiar with that. It's kind of the classic undulating up and down wave that you see on an oscilloscope or whatever, and that shape, again, relates to the circle. It's just basically putting it into a time sequence. So we can think of lines, frequencies radiating out from a point, from a central point like the sun. Obviously, our whole physical existence is contingent on the vibrations of our central star here reaching the Earth and heating it up and doing much more than that, of course. But it's a good metaphor. So every time you see something that reminds you of different colors or different sounds or even smells, and the idea of vibrations comes to mind, you can recognize that is a geometric metaphor that has to do with a complete cycle. And that completion, again, is an example or a metaphor seen from an inclusive transpersonal perspective as accepting or allowing all experience or all frequencies or all vibrations within the dream of space-time as being equally fine. And then the other approach would be to resist or to fight every experience, and that's just what, you know, makes it all the more difficult. I think we all have probably countless personal examples of how that works. So yet another example of a geometric metaphor that can be used to remind us that what we choose to receive in terms of the vibratory influences is our choice, as well as, even more importantly, how we interpret them, whether we interpret them from a transpersonal or a personal standpoint. So that's the third of the three Hermetic laws, of the seven Hermetic laws, right? And then the fourth one is the law of polarity, which we've already kind of touched on, because these laws are so interconnected. And I think that's one of the things about sacred geometry that got me so interested in is really all these shapes and all these principles, and truly all of us are interconnected, and we merely seem to think that there's differences among bodies and personas and planets and what all else, because we find that convenient, but it's made up. And there's so many mystical traditions that remind us that it really is a fabrication of the mind. And part of that fabrication is this law of polarity, which is really the heart of duality, or thinking that there are opposites. And there's sort of a medical principle involved here that in terms of what we truly are, there really can be no opposites. So it's only in the realm of illusion, or in the realm of, as the Eastern folks call it, Maya, that we have opposites or polarizations. But we can use the law of polarity to either heal or to destroy, like all the other laws. We can use polarization to bring us above the battleground of duality. I like the kind of metaphor of the Cheshire Cat smiling above the chessboard in Alice in Wonderland. And there's that inner peaceful grin that happens when we realize we catch ourselves warring or competing or fighting against one side or another. And I kind of draw from that we-they paradigm silliness. And whenever we find ourselves on a level of feeling, doesn't mean that we can't have preferences. You know, like, hey, I participated in the last election, but it's our attachment to outcomes. It's our attachment to one particular circumstance being better than or worse than, and that the feeling and the oomph and the emphasis that we put behind that determines how manipulated, really, we are by circumstance. And so the law of polarity is hugely powerful, in that if we can sort of mentally be like a Cheshire Cat and just look down on the battlefield of our, not only what seems to be everyone else's lives, but our own life, and see ourselves in that context, as our little bodies and personas are just like little, you know, pawns on a gigantic chessboard. And if we can identify with what we all are together, and what our shared interest is, rather than our individual polarized separate interests are, then we can stop demonizing others, and we can stop making wars on an internal level, which of course then propagates into an outer level. So that's where, again, a law of polarity can be really helpful. So I think a triangle is another example of a geometric symbol that can be used as a metaphor for the law of polarity. You can imagine kind of like a flat representation of the Great Pyramid. If you just have an equilateral triangle, say, the base is flat on one side on the ground, and you have a point that's above the two points on the ground, that it's sort of like that Cheshire Cat. It's like that perspective, or the eye of the capstone of the pyramid, if you will, that looks down on the dream of duality and says, okay, I'm seeing my life, and I'm seeing the circumstances of my life, and I'm recognizing that I get caught in this, but I can forgive myself and catch myself in an amused way, rather than a blame or punishing kind of way. Just say, oh wow, look, I caught myself getting caught up in this strong preference or out and out warfare. You know, it takes the whole spectrum there of along that line of polarity. We can say, okay, do I really want to just let go of this and find the peace in that? It doesn't mean that you behave any differently, but inwardly you can catch yourself identifying with a polarized identity, and letting go of that, I think, can be really helpful. So just picturing yourself as the apex of the triangle, or the Cheshire grin of the cat looking down over the chessboard of all the different opposites and warring factions, and just say, okay, well, you know, maybe I don't have to get quite so involved in that on a personal investment level as I used to. So there's again another law and another geometric symbol that can can be used on everyday life. So every time you see a triangle, or for that matter, just a line that's got, you know, a horizontal line that defines one opposite and another opposite, and you can say, oh, well, those opposites really ultimately meet and reconcile in an awareness that's beyond duality, that, like you say, is all-encompassing. So that's the fourth of the Hermetic laws of polarity. The fifth is a law of rhythm, and I think a geometric symbol for that that works really well is a spiral. And again, another very feminine form that you think of the meanders of rivers and the spirals of in nature, from fiddle ferns to the inner ear to, well, I know this is a program for women, the female reproductive system. Everywhere you go in nature, there are examples of spirals, and it's a symbol that represents the principle of rhythm. And again, rhythm can be used to reinforce a belief in separation, or it can be used to liberate us from that, depending on how we use each experience as each season or each opportunity comes around the grand cycles of life to release and let go of attachments to outcomes and attachments to form and sort of. So ironically, I'm sort of a heretic, I guess, in the realm of sacred geometry these days, because I think that we can use form to go beyond form. And that's kind of where I've been going with it in the last few years. So then you have the law of rhythm then can be used as a anytime you see a spiral, you can say, oh, well, there's a principle that says I can take the circumstances and the habitual patterns and the rhythms and the things that I do over and over again to reinforce kindness, or I can use it to erode it. Again, it's all a matter of choice. So again, another real simple symbol that's everywhere you look. Spirals are just about everywhere you go. Obviously, in classic sacred geometry, you have things like the seed head of a sunflower seed, sunflower, where you have the spirals. If you count the clockwise and the counterclockwise spirals on a sunflower head, you have, I think it's 21 or 34, and then so many different flowers are that way. You have these counter-rotating spirals, and they're all relationships or ratios of Fibonacci numbers that we talked about earlier. So here you have a very literal geometric metaphor that can remind us that we're either evolving or devolving, or, you know, spiraling out to encompass everything, or shrinking down to embrace nothing, depending on what thought system we're looking at. And then the last two laws are cause and effect and gender or generation. So it looks like we're kind of running out of time. So I'll go over this real quickly so we can maybe have a few minutes for other questions. So the law of cause and effect, I think any kind of a fractal is a good geometric metaphor for the law of cause and effect, because every choice we make is like a domino effect of spreading out and then affecting all the other, the billiard ball metaphor of Newtonian physics actually is can be helpful in the sense that we can say every action that we take, every choice we make, then reflects in countless other choices and countless other shifts in the quantum sea of possibilities that one kindness, for example, made to yourself or someone else, you know, ultimately there's no difference there, can then propagate and then become the cause for other effects that wouldn't have been possible had not that choice been made. So it all comes back to moment choosing how we want to feel and how we want to think. And I think that's why it's so crucial to identify with the cause, which is how we want to interpret what's happening, versus the effect, which is what seems to be coming in through our senses and our experience. And then the last of the seven Hermetic laws is the law of gender or generation, which is basically saying that there's male and female in everything, or masculine and feminine principles. And the idea that if you imagine a yin-yang symbol and then make a fractal out of that, because ultimately we have two parents, four grandparents, eight great-grandparents, and so on out to, well, let's see, how does that work then? Because if you go back enough generations, you have more people that were involved in bringing us biologically into existence than we're ever on the planet. Anybody figure that one out? I haven't figured that one out,
yeah.
But fun to ponder, huh? So then you have this law of generation that says that what we use with, again, this kind of the summary or the culmination of the other six laws, mentalism, correspondence, vibration, polarity, rhythm, cause and effect, and it's basically saying that all those laws working together will generate in like kind, just like if you plant a tomato seed, you get a tomato. If you plant a cucumber seed, you're going to get a cucumber. And the nature or the genetics in biological sense, but in the mental sense, I think is where it's real important, is the nature of the thought system. If it's inclusive and you know, based on kindness and that all-encompassing sharing that is what leads to the abolition of wars, whether they be literal or figurative, then generates after its kind. Whereas the grievance factor and the unwillingness to forgive and the unwillingness to let go of attachments to outcomes and so forth, that becomes a generation in a you know, a decomposing sense or a collapsing sense. So the universe actually is you know, completely designed to support us in finding that transpersonal awareness and using these symbols. So anyway, I think those can be helpful, and there are so many places that you look in nature. So, you know, and again, like the law of cause and effect, the fractals, every time you see a tree, you can think of the branching of that tree as like the branching that happens with one cause triggers multiple effects, which each become the cause of yet more effects and so forth and so on. So all these geometric symbols, again, are just placeholders, and it's not the symbols that are important, but the principles behind them that ultimately lead to an awareness that's beyond all principles. And so I find that this is really can be really helpful. And so that's kind of a quick summary in less than an hour of some of the things I've been fascinated with for many years. And I've got a whole bunch more stuff on the website, the Geometry Code website. And another study that I've gotten into in the last few years that I picked up in the mid-80s and really gotten back into that because I think it really corroborates really nicely is A Course in Miracles. And at first blush, it looks like a religious document, but it's really not. And it's really about non-duality. And it really, I think, ties in beautifully with a lot of the Eastern modalities and the pure non-dualistic ideas that modern physics is really leading us toward. So, you know, if any of your listeners have a curiosity about that, or maybe some of them probably already spend a lot of time in that study, but I find it real, real helpful. I'm involved with a number of study groups here locally in the Ashland, Oregon area, and also we've got friends that like to hang out and talk about geometry, and so it's kind of fun to just see where all this is going. So. Anyway, there's a quick overview of some of the things I've been involved in the last few years in particular.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's mind-boggling. And with the cause and effect one, maybe I missed it, but what is the symbol for the cause and effect?
Oh, cause and effect, yeah. If you think, I use the term fractal, I probably should have defined that. Some of your listeners may not be familiar with that term. The idea of a fractal is something that, depending on how far you zoom in or out, it looks the same. If you take, for example, the branch of a fern, and you look at the overall large branch, and then you look at one little sub-branch of it, you'll notice that the smaller sub-branch looks very much like the larger branch. And then if you take a sub-branch of a sub-branch, you'll notice that the sub-branch looks sub-sub-branch looks like the sub-branch, and so on. Then you can keep zooming in, and you find that similarity. And I think so. Any time you have a geometric fractal like that, it's a pattern that looks the same no matter how you zoom in. Companies like Lucasfilm, ILM, and all those kind of things that do all the special effects for all the high-tech movies these days use fractal technology everywhere you turn to make, you know, very realistic-looking landscapes of mountains and trees and all that kind of stuff. And they use fractal technology all the time because it's basically mimicking or an approximation of a lot of these natural patterns that we see. The shores and coastlines of countries or islands can be also examined and analyzed using fractal geometry. A real pertinent example is our blood system, our circulatory system, and also the system of the our lungs. If you look at the branching that goes on in our lungs, or the capillaries, and you know the connection between the capillaries, arteries, and veins, and all that is very much a fractal. You know, with the root being the heart, and then of the tree, so to speak, metaphorically. And then if you think of a tree, you know, just kind of above the horizon, you think of, well, the roots down below are the cause, and the effect is all the branches and the things that is evident above the surface. But the cause is really the important part, because without the roots, there would be no tree. and obviously, it's a symmetrical system, because the tree also needs the respiration from the branches and so forth. But in this metaphor, if you think of the, you know, without the roots, the tree is certainly not going to be standing up straight, and in most cases, unless you're in a zero gravity environment, I guess. But anyway, I think it's a good metaphor. And you, every time you see, you know, a plant, you can think, oh, well, what's the cause? What's the root? Several years ago, I was doing process improvement consulting for the Air Force, and we were studying the Japanese system that was basically promoted by Toyota originally, called the five whys, and they would look at the cause of all the different manufacturing processes they were doing. And they were saying, well, okay, if we want to make this a better product and make it more efficient, why do we do things a certain way? And they started looking at their whole manufacturing operations from ground to ground up, and realized that if they analyzed the why, they would be getting really wonderful insights as to how to make it more efficient. Well, what's cool about that is you can go beyond five whys. You can keep going to all the way back to, well, why am I here? You know, in a metaphysical sense. And so I think it's interesting that both science and industry and so many areas in our lives, ultimately, if you take the metaphysics and the metaphors and just keep applying them deeper and deeper, you get to this mystical understanding that reminds us that there really isn't any separation, and that the seeming differences are just artificial. And,
right.
Yeah.
But I look at sacred geometry as where the right brain and the left brain come together.
Oh, of course, absolutely. And I think that's why it's really fun to and maybe should back up a little bit too, is in terms of the sacred geometry, it's really fun to just take a compass and a straight edge and draw a flower of life pattern, just basically take a circle and then move the without changing the dimension on the compass, move your compass over to the edge of this first circle and draw another circle. And there, so you've made the first two symbols of this sequence, with the circle and then the vesica Pisces. And then you can continue that process and make six circles around the one, and you get what's called the seed of life. And then you add another dozen circles around that, and you get the what's called the flower of life, which has been etched into, literally burned into stone in the Abydos temple in ancient Egypt, which is in the Assyrian temple underneath the Ptolemaic temple, which is a mere 2,000 years old, that was built on top of it. When we were with Greg Braden in that fall of 92, we walked down this plank to these huge granite monoliths, and the flower of life symbol was burned onto these granite monoliths there. And how they did it, I don't know, but it's you know, if it was paint, it would have flaked off a long time ago, but it looked like it was somehow, you know, chemically or who knows, altered and built into that stone there. But that's kind of a neat symbol, because it reminds us that pattern repeats in not just two dimensions, but three dimensions and really beyond that. And one of the things I've been having fun in recent years too is I have some colleagues that are far more knowledgeable about this than I, that look at these geometric shapes in four and five and more dimensions. And in three dimensions, there's exactly five polyhedra, which is the cube is kind of most familiar to most listeners. And the cube is just a six-sided shape that has six squares. Well, there's also the tetrahedron, the octahedron, the icosahedron, and the dodecahedron. And those shapes all have the same number of faces, the same angles, the same side lengths, and so forth. And they're what's called regular three-dimensional solids. But it turns out that in four dimensions, which is kind of boggling, but mathematically robust, there are exactly six hyper solids, if you will, or the hypercube is a kind of a more famous example. But there's six polychora that have these examples. And I actually gave a presentation a few weeks ago in California to a group of cell biologists that were looking to look how to visualize data in more than three dimensions. And so I was using this as a metaphor. It's like, well, you can also look at the same problem of you've got these shapes that are perfectly robust and rigorously true in mathematical sense that exist in four dimensions, but we just can't see them. But you can take three-dimensional slices through four-dimensional shapes and animate them. And you can see the consistency as you go from frame to frame in the animation. So I was using that as a metaphor for this particular audience, and it was kind of fun. And I've got links to that on the links page on my Geometry Code website if anybody wants to check those out. A lot of fun stuff there. And it's just so many wonderful people doing wonderful things. So
it's amazing. It's just fascinating. So, and again, we're at the top of the hour. Thank you this amazing hour. I mean, you have really given light to a very complex subject, and I appreciate, the seven laws, because that gives us, sometimes sacred geometry, and you look at all, it can become so overwhelming. And to break it down and saying, okay, wait a minute, this is something that matters on a day-to-day basis, on a moment-to-moment. It can give me, some depth to things that you think about and directions that you want to go. I mean, I love curiosity, being curious for the sake of curiosity. It's your birthright, and this gets your curiosity up, to say the least.
And again, it's not the geometric forms or the symbols that is so important, but the meaning behind them that's the universal, and that's what we are, because we're universal. We just think of ourselves as personal because we've taught ourselves
and
to do that.
Right, and that's where the women, the ladies, you can personalize it. You can make it. You can bring it into your day-to-day life, and
exactly.
It can become a tool. And that's what these calls are all about: is giving women tools, giving them option, giving them ways to empower themselves, to find that strength, that core within them, to do what they need to do with the gifts that they have. So, on that, I thank you, And ladies, what I do want to do is give you Bruce's website. It is www.geometrycode.com. And there's lots of free shapes, there's art, there's links, it's a wealth of knowledge. Also go to www.brucerawles, and that's rawles.com, to read Bruce's blog, see what interesting things he's up to, and it sounds like it's not interesting, it's amazing what you're up to. And then also check out the website Intense Design Studio. It's an amazing website, it's for great art, sacred geometry, it's a wonderful, wonderful website. So, again, thank you, Bruce, for giving us this hour and taking the time.
My pleasure.
This wonderful knowledge. And, ladies, I will leave everyone with a quote today, and it is by Richard Stanley. And he says, "There is no limit as to what can be understood through the study of sacred geometry, as this science explores and explains the web of energy that creates and unifies all things." So again, thank you, Bruce, and goodbye to everybody.
Thank you.